In 1990, 7-year-old Julia Yaffe and her family fled the Soviet Union. Nearly 20 years later, Yaffe returned to Moscow only to discover just how much Russian society had changed while she had been living in America. The Soviet women she had known growing up, doctors, engineers, scientists, seemed to have been replaced by women desperate to marry rich and become stay-at-home moms. How had Russia gone from portraying itself as the vanguard of world feminism to becoming a bastion of conservative Christian values? That's the teaser for Julia Yaffe's new book, Motherland, A Feminist History of Modern Russia, From Revolution to Autocracy, now available in bookstores everywhere. It's a blend of memoir, historical analysis, and Julia's own field reporting. Motherland is also a finalist for the National Book Award, and you've likely already heard about it, and about the author, Julia Yaffe, if you're at all familiar with American writing about Russia. I'm your host, Kevin Rothrock, and I'm excited to welcome Julia back to the podcast today to talk about this culmination of some 7 years of work. Welcome to the Naked Pravda. This book, did it evolve as a memoir about the women in your family into sort of a grand feminist history of Russia, or was it like the other way around, or did you always think, okay, once you settled on the idea, and you talk in your book about, you know, how you come to this idea of writing about this subject generally, but like in terms of mixing sort of like grand history and your own family, how did that come about?
Well, it was to explain to a mostly American audience why it was so normal to have great-grandmothers who were doctors and scientists and the like. And I realized that to do that, you have to tell the whole history of the Bolshevik feminist experiment from the ideas that inspired it. And then once you do that, then you're like, oh, well, then I have to tell the story of the Civil War and the purges and World War II. And then before you know it, you're rewriting 150 years of Russian history through the eyes of its women, which, while super interesting, is also quite a task.
And was it always going to be chronological? I mean, you do bounce around a bit.
Yeah, it was going to be chronological once I settled on the structure, which was inspired by a conversation I had with Nina Khrushcheva, Nikita's granddaughter or great-granddaughter. And although she's both, because her mother was adopted by her grandparents as a daughter. So that kind of collapsed one generation on paper. Anyway. She said to me, and this line is in the book, she said, have you noticed that the fate of the women at the top, the wives of the leaders, reflects the fate of the country as a whole? And that gave me the idea to use the women at the top as the vehicle for telling the big history of, you know, the Civil War, the purges, World War II, et cetera. Like, what happened and how did women's role in Soviet society and then in Russian society, how did policy around that question evolve? And then into that, I could write, like, they provided a vehicle to tell the context, the historical context. And then I could tell having set that up, I could tell the story of my foremothers, because then it would make sense why their lives looked the way they did.
And how did you decide between, like, because they're even among the women outside your family, there seems like that, like some of them kind of fall into this category of like women who are prominent for their own achievements. And then there are others who are mentioned mostly because of like the men they or have relationships to in history. Although some of these women are then kind of, you put them back in the category of being exceptional themselves. But like, there's a difference, I think, between, you know, like someone like Kurupskaya with someone like, mm-hmm. I don't know, like Raisa Gorbachova, like they're both exceptional, but like one of them you describe as kind of like actually running, having some kind of like administrative like role in history. And the other one is like an exceptional person. But like when you're deciding like on the women that are going to basically represent the course of what are some of the like criteria?
Well, on the whole, I looked at the first ladies, even though they weren't called first ladies, you know, the Krupskas and the Raisas, who, by the way, I think are much more similar than they are different in the sense of, you know, being closer to the peer relationship with their husbands than, say, Stalin and Nadezhda Liloeva or Putin and Lyudmila, where it was very much a master-subject relationship. So yeah, I tried to use that narrative device that was suggested by the conversation with Nina. And I was just like, all right, we did one, you know, I would pick one first lady and then through her tell the history wrought by her husband, because that was a way to tell kind of the big strokes of history without having the men take us through as they usually do in every other history. So even though they have become historical figures in part because of the men they had relationships with, it was still in my mind better than writing yet another history that centered Lenin or Stalin or Putin.
Okay.
The other thing I should say is that the one person that I think doesn't quite fit this model is Svetlana Liloeva, Stalin's only daughter. She was not a first lady. She was not exactly a prominent figure in the Soviet Union. I don't know that a lot of people knew about her. But to me, she was the perfect metaphor for Russia. She was in some ways a first lady because after her father's death, Stalin's obsession kind of shifted to her, and he called her his хозяюшка. And then the fact that, you know, the fact that she was, and this audience would understand it more than any other, the pitching from one extreme to the other to get away from Stalin's shadow and from the trauma that Stalin inflicted on her, first by idealizing and idolizing the West and saying, screw Russia, forget everything Russian, I'm now part of the West because it's beautiful and free. And then being like, wait, this is what freedom in the West looks like? This is so, I miss the Russian soul, and Americans are so small-minded and money-obsessed. I'm going back to Russia and then back again and then back again, right? And to me, that is so much the history of Russia, the pitching from extreme to extreme, hating the West, loving the West, sure, rejecting the West, trying to be part of it, feeling embittered and rejecting the West.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of great stuff in there about Svetlana. That's what we're talking about, right?
Yeah, Svetlana. Plus her story is
incredible,
just
yeah,
addictive. Like, what a life. And she was quite a brilliant woman, very troubled, obviously. But I heard that, you know, when she defected, the CIA administered an IQ test and she scored better than almost everyone who had defected.
Is that a standard thing for defectors?
That's what I heard. I don't know.
Okay. I had a question about the section on her, but before I ask that, I was wondering if I could also ask the in terms of first ladies and just sort of, and like you said, Svetlana kind of is, I mean, you talk about her mother in the book too, but she's the sort of main woman of the Stalin era in the book. There's not really anything about the Yeltsin era, I noticed. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was interesting because Tatiana Yumasheva actually had an official role in the administration. And I kept waiting for her to pop up as a sort of like modern day Krupskaya. And like, instead of fighting Stalin, it's Yumasheva fighting Korzhakov or something. And like, is there a reason that that didn't come in? Is it just, what was the reason?
And then there was Naina as well. In part, it was because of space. And in the third part of the book, which deals with post-1991 Russia, the focus changes to my perspective. Sure. And I totally miss the 90s. I completely miss the 90s in Russia. So it was basically like Cliff's Notes version of what happened in the 90s, but also scattered throughout the chapters, right? The 90s come up throughout for obvious reasons, rather than a dedicated chapter to them, because then this book would have been 600 pages.
What's another 100 pages?
Tell my editor that.
So getting back to the bits about Svetlana in the United States, there's this section where you talk about how she basically, this is something I did not know the history of this at all, but she falls in with like a cult headed by Frank Lloyd Wright's widow. And we then learn that she's busy trying to rewrite his history and casting herself as his muse. And I thought this was like fascinating stuff, obviously, just as like this person's life story. But it also got me thinking, you know, a lot of what you're working with are memoirs, not exclusively. You have a very, you know, long bibliography. And I have a question about that too. But a lot of memoirs. And I wonder, since this is this character in the story who is writing what seems to be a sort of unreliable memoir, how do you deal with stories you see in memoirs that you might suspect or maybe not so reliable? Because I assume it's inevitable that people writing about their lives are going to start, they're going to embellish or downplay, et cetera. So like, how did you deal with that in your research?
By considering exactly that and relying on other sources to juxtapose what they were saying. But I thought that so for example, for Svetlana's life, I didn't have just her memoirs. I also had a really wonderful biography of her by Rosemary Sullivan and various, you know, press reports about her. She wasn't the sole...
Just as like a methodological kind of question.
Yeah. But I do find the person's own voice to be so important. And that was also part of the project here too, is that so many of these women had been written out of Soviet history. I mean, I majored in this stuff in college. I kept reading about it for years and years afterwards, and I didn't know who the hell Kalantai was or Inés Armand was. I didn't know any of this stuff. And I would say the stuff that made me most squeamish as like a amateur historian was the testimony of Lalia Drozdova and her mother, the young woman who was raped by Beria, because that came from the files of kind of the case against Beria after he was arrested and tried in secret. And as we know, a lot of confessions were written for the people. A lot of interrogations were, I mean, most testimony was obtained under torture. And so I wrestled with whether or not to quote Lalia and her mother, because their testimony was included in this diela, in the case. And it read, you know, like a lot of testimonies you've read from the NKVD archives.
And they testified before he was executed?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah. I mean, it was, right, it was a case put together in order to take Beria out politically before they took him out physically.
Right.
That he was mostly accused of all kinds of other stuff, spying for the British, terrorism, whatever. He wasn't really charged with rape or anything like that.
This is like one of your biggest like correctives on like the history that's been written.
Yeah. But then I thought back to one of my favorite histories of the Soviet Union, which was Robert Conquest's The Great Terror. And I remembered that he quoted extensively from the testimonies that had been obtained under torture, etc. And he treated them, you know, with the skepticism they deserve, but he also did treat them as the person's voice with the correctives of, like, we know this person was tortured. Lalia, I don't think, was tortured. Her mom wasn't tortured, but they clearly were like, hey, we're going to take this guy out. Can you please say some stuff about him? So that, in the end, was why I decided to quote from both their testimonies at such length, with the caveat that, like, this comes from the government's case against Beria. We don't know how much of this was actually in their voice, but still, given how much we quote from dubious state documents in other contexts, why not quote these women who were otherwise quite powerless?
Howdy, folks. Just a brief interruption from yours truly to remind listeners that I write a daily newsletter for Medusa. It's every weekday. Don't ask me about Saturday and Sunday. Sign up and you'll get exclusive daily stories and analysis and links to Medusa's daily news digest, which I also write.
Visit our website, medusa.io/en. Scroll all the way to the bottom, and you'll find a sign-up sheet. Hope to be in your inbox. Okay, back to the interview.
So I mentioned that the book has an extensive bibliography and extensive endnotes. And I wish they were footnotes because I was constantly going back. And I was like, damn it, I know that that doesn't look as pretty, but like I hate having to go back to the back. But anyway, I did that. And one question I had was, the bibliography is obviously has sources that are not in the endnotes because like it's just informing your thinking on background in many ways. Which book from the bibliography off the top of your head would you say influenced this project the most that isn't cited directly in an endnote?
Secondhand Time by Alexievich. That was another person I had never heard of until she won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2015. And I know she's gotten some shit from people for the way she's edited things and conflated things, but what I found revolutionary about her work was that, I mean, revolutionary for me, was that she thought about history how I had always thought about it, which was constantly imagining myself in these historical time periods. Like, what would it have felt like to, I don't know, live in ancient Rome or to be a peasant in Byzantium? And what would it have felt like to be waiting at the gates of Christi? What would it have felt like to survive the Civil War or the Revolution or to witness any of this stuff? I mean, I always hungered for that sense of like that emotional texture. Because I think you can't read Alexievich as like, this happened, then this happened, then this happened. But I also get very frustrated with standard histories and nonfiction books is they're so dry. And there's this sense, I think, because of the Western post-Enlightenment tradition and because it's such a male-dominated field, like every field, there's a sense that emotion is lowly and not a valid form of information and is, if anything, disinformation, which to me is a completely inaccurate portrayal of how we live our lives and how we make our decisions and how we interact with the world and the people around us. And reading Secondhand Time, already knowing the historical things that she's events that she's referring to in the book, I was like, oh, this is what it felt like. Like, I don't care if this one character was actually two people in real life. I don't care because there was a different kind of truth that she was getting at, a truthiness, if you will.
Okay. You write in the book that Nadia Telekonikova, the Pussy Riot mm-hmm. lead woman, mm-hmm. that she had
founder,
lead woman, head of it, you know, the star, mm-hmm. That she admired Krupskaya, all these Bolshevik revolutionaries. Near the end of the book, you write that you're writing about Yulia Navalnaya. You're writing about a soldier's wife, a soldier who has been deployed to Ukraine. The wife is still there, and they're going through very different motions, but you know they're shared motions. But it's like they're responding differently, let's say, to the events of the world. And you write that they're both the latest in a long line of women. They're heirs to the women that had toppled the Romanov dynasty. And you know, phrases like this, I wonder, do you think that is that a sentiment of like historical continuity that is like conscious and resonates with most Russian women? Or is that like you're observing that in them?
It's me observing that in them and placing them kind of against their will in that historical context. I think to Nadia's point that she makes when I interviewed her for the book is that most Russians and most Russian women are ignorant of this history. They think that feminism was imported from the West, and is this kind of Western invasive species, and which is very much in the interest of Putin for Russians to believe that. Because these female revolutionaries were written out of a lot of Soviet and Russian history, people don't know about it. I don't know if Yulia Navalnaya knows about them. I didn't know about them. I don't know if Maria Andreeva knows about them. I didn't know about them. But having learned about them and having gotten to know them in my research, it seemed undeniable. I mean, they were, whether they recognized it or not, they are part of this historical lineage.
Do you feel like the women in your stories, do they feel like historical stakes and heritage? Because that seems to me like, it seems like you see the sort of like heritage in your, in everything, all the people you're writing about. It's like no one's an isolated case. No one's just a guy in the corner of a room doing something on his own. It's like everything's like connected. And there's like historical significance in like Joe Schmo or Ivan Ivanovich, as it were, or the women in the story, rather. Anyway, you get the idea. but like, this is, I don't know if there's a question in this, but it just strikes me that like it's a particular way of viewing the world.
But isn't that also kind of how Russians see themselves?
Yeah, maybe.
and how Europeans see themselves, and how pretty much everyone but Americans see themselves.
It is distinctly not American, I think.
Americans are, you know, notoriously ahistorical. Yeah. They think that the world began when they were born or conceived.
Sure. Whatever. That's a fierce individualism. Also, let's put a positive spin on it.
Yeah, I'm not saying one is good or bad, but I think also, I mean, how else do you write a history if everybody's just a discrete individual?
Difficult.
I mean, you and I, as people who have studied history, know that, I mean, there's a reason we're drawn to it, is because it connects those dots. It connects these seemingly disparate stories into patterns, and there's something intriguing and satisfying about that. And like, it's honestly true. And I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. And I hope I succeeded in showing that in the book, that we are all a product of our histories and what we have, what our families have bequeathed to us, and the context that shaped us and the history that shaped that context. But we are also individuals making our own decisions as far as we're able. And there's always kind of a tension inherent in that, and that's also where a lot of interesting stuff happens.
Was that an obstacle in like framing the book, that knowing that your primary audience is American and that they tend to be this sort of like, they have this mindset, I'll just speak personally, like that it's like, you know, you don't see your connection to anybody you haven't like met in person. Like, it's just a series of like, you know, three generations, and like going back beyond that is kind of, it feels silly. Like, that seems like a huge obstacle to writing a history book. And this is a history book set in a place where that makes perfect sense for a lot of people. And you're writing for an audience where that's maybe a hurdle. Did that come into play?
Not in that way, because I figured anybody who was going to pick up a book that was a history of Russia was going
to
self-select.
Yeah, you don't have to, you have to win them over.
Like, there was a point when somebody in the publishing house was worried that people would think that the matryoshka on the cover is a bowling pin because it's white. And I was like, well, if they do, that's probably not our demographic.
It's a beautiful cover. I mean, I'm sure some Russians are probably like, oh, another matryoshka, like, give me a break. But like, for an American audience, it seems absolutely perfect to me.
Yeah. So my bigger issue was balancing trying to explain this thing from scratch to an American reader while not boring, like an American reader who didn't really know the history, and telling them enough about like, here's what happened in Russia in World War I, and then here's what happened in the Civil War, without getting bogged down in the details, but then also still making it interesting for somebody like you or our many friends who know Russia very deeply. And I was constantly giving various chapters to read to people you and I are friends with, or to my parents. I mean, like, is this new for you at all? Is this boring for you at all? Is this redundant? Like, trying to educate and engage, probably not entertain, and engage people who know nothing about it and people who know a lot about it was the constant balancing act. And that was tough to do.
I can imagine.
And that was done by my editor to be like, that's take that out. Or like, I don't know what the hell that is. Add a sentence. And I'm like, how do you not know that? Anyway, so that was a constant back and forth.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, to listeners who haven't like followed your work or even looked at the book, it's like, it's an immense amount of work. That's evident. It's kind of incredible. Like I'm holding the book right now and knowing like the amount of work went into it is like, makes the book feel kind of like more than like paper. It's very cool.
Well, thank you. That's very nice. Cause it was.
Yeah. I'm not making it up, folks. One of the central tenets of the book is that like the context for women's rights, feminism, whatever you want to call it, very different in the United States and Russia. And like, you know, many of the tenets are different. The expectations are different. You get some kind of like cross wires at times. One of the most memorable ones is somebody commissioning you for a story and asking you to like find out what the Pussy Riot members' positions on abortion are.
Or what their husbands think.
What their husbands think. Great. Even better.
Which I think
And like just an example of how there's like, you know, the localized versions of feminism or whatever, again, whatever the best word for that is, like that they're not quite in sync a lot of the time. Given how there's been some conversions between like women's rights in Russia and the United States very recently, do you think that would like the sequel to your book? And I know that Russia doesn't have a future, but let's pretend that it gets a little reprieve and has a future of some kind. Do you see like there being more in common? Like will conversations be easier? Or do you think that they're still going to be kind of talking past each other?
I think both. And I don't think that Russia doesn't have a future. I just think that its future looks a lot like its past and its present, which is also true of America and most countries. And here I reveal myself to be kind of a Kotkinite. Slash maybe essentialist. But yeah, I think because in broad strokes, feminism in Russia and feminism in America were both about emancipating women and allowing women into the workforce and unchaining them from marriages they didn't want to be in and protecting them from sexual violence and securing their reproductive rights and their ability to plan families. But the specifics of that naturally will differ because the contexts are different. You know, there's a reason Americans don't understand why Russians put ukrop on everything. And that's because it's one of the only green things that grows. You know, like it's these like local idiosyncrasies that shape the policy. And yeah, there's definitely a convergence now. And I don't think that's by accident. I think both sides on the American right and in the Kremlin love that and admire each other for it. But again, I think it looks different. Like there are a lot of women in America who follow these trad wives on social media, but the trad wives in American social media are advertising this kind of homesteader aesthetic where you make everything from scratch and you have 9 to 15 kids. But I don't think women in Russia aspire to that. Like that's not the traditional model they aspire to. They still don't want to have a ton of kids and they don't want to make anything from scratch anymore. They've been doing that. I think they just want to relax a little bit and do a little have to do a little less. They want men who will carry their own weight and carry them for a change as opposed to the reverse. So there's a divergence there underneath that whole kind of Christian nationalist, imperialist, violently heteronormatively conformist strain that we're seeing in both Russia and the US right now.
I was going to ask you a question about the New York Times calling you a snob, but I feel like it's a cheap one.
Let's do it.
Well, okay. I feel like I've already touched on it a little bit, actually. Like, so, like, in a very positive review of Motherland, that's how I wrote this out. In a very positive review of Motherland, the New York Times accused you of snobbery, highlighting a passage in the Julia chapter where you say, as a child and as a recent immigrant, that you kind of look down on your classmates And then you look down at them for like vacationing, and this is now I'm editorializing, for going to Florida and seeing Broadway musicals, and I'm reading this and I'm like, this sounds fancy too. You're like, but I'm someone with like good table manners. And so like the metaphor that developed in my head was like, okay, you've got good table manners, your classmates have bad table manners, and I'm not at this table. this is already too fancy, these people at this table. But like, I think they're kind of, the review is poking a little, it's like teasing you. It's not like a serious accusation of snobbery. Although the New York Review of Books does have a more like critical review of your like Western liberal, whatever, expatriate kind of like, they mm-hmm. they throw you in that block or whatever. But I wonder, like, do you feel like the book falls into some kind of trap that it's like gonna, is it gonna like lose readers because it's like too couched in like a class experience? I mean, I know that this book is a feminist history. It's not your unit of analysis has nothing to do with class, but like one could argue that there's like all these like class signifiers everywhere throughout the book. I mean, you do get into like how affluent people are and so on. Do you think that kind of like commentary or criticism and like you acknowledging yourself that your identity is like, part of it is baked into the fact that like you are from, I mean, like, it's, you have all these accomplished women in your family, and you like, look, I know you. You are an exceptional person, and like the people in your life are exceptional. Like, do you think that you can connect with like people who are not? Because that's most people, I would assume.
So, about the thing about the snobbery and coming by her snobbery. Honestly, I laughed because I was like, okay, clocked. And she flicks at this in the review, but I think if you read it in situ, you see that it's like an immigrant's defense mechanism. You know, when you're a kid who didn't make the decision to uproot your life and have to learn a new language and be in a totally new environment, not just linguistically, but culturally. I was in a religious day school and my family was completely secular. And your family has no money because you're recent refugees, and these are the kids of lawyers and doctors and living really well. So there's that class distinction. And every day they're telling you, you ugly Russian bitch, go back to Russia. Then you're like, you can either take that on board and be like, yes, I suck and I'm horrible. I'm not American enough and I don't have the right nice clothes, and my parents live in a townhouse as opposed to like a McMansion, and they drive used cars as opposed to Alexis, like Sarah's mom. Or you can come back with like, you're not that great. I'm actually better. I actually have something that you couldn't possibly access either. And that is what I'm getting at home, which is, you know, my mother's insistence, which I think you'll recognize in most kind of Muscovites of a certain type, right? This love of the theater and classical music and constantly, I mean, this is not, in Moscow, this is not a super snobby way to be, if you recall your time there. Like, yeah, there are, you know, rough kind of working class parts of Russia, but of Moscow, but that part of the culture is so central in the city and in other places in Russia too. I mean, it's insisted on all the time. This is our like great cultural tradition. And, you know, the Americans might be rich, but we have ballet, right? So I think what she didn't capture there, like I said, was the kind of defensive mechanism that was inherent in that.
I mean, to be fair, you get it throughout the book, you're pointing out that what people perceive as unusual in your family, which is all the doctors who are women, is not mm-hmm. unusual in Russia. And so that's part of the disconnect.
And also, I mean, speaking of the class thing, like my dad will often cite the story where some American acquaintance of his, on learning that my dad was a computer programmer and my mom was a doctor in Russia, he's like, wow, you guys must have been really well off. And he was like, our two salaries combined was less than that of a bus driver in Moscow. The class hierarchy was very different in the Soviet Union. It's very different now. Doctors don't make a lot of money even now in Russia. and in the Soviet Union, where women were mostly primary care providers and more on the level of kind of where nurses are in the U.S. today, it was not really the kind of high-grossing, high-status career that it is in the U.S. So I would challenge those people and say, okay, that you're projecting an American class structure and understanding onto a place that had a very different history. And as for, like, can I connect with the everyday person? Like, I don't know, but I don't know that that was my intent. Like, does the everyday person want to read a feminist history of Russia? Does the everyday person want to read a 500-page history, period, of anything? Probably not, but that's okay. Like, not everything is for everyone. And as long as we're not saying, you know, I'm better than you and I deserve to dominate you and deserve to take away your rights, then what's wrong with that?
Yep. Okay.
That's my interview with Julia Ioffe, the author of the new book, Motherland, A Feminist History of Modern Russia from Revolution to Autocracy, available in bookstores everywhere. As always, please consider making a recurring donation to help sustain Medusa's journalism. Thanks for listening, and until next time.